You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Well, hello everyone. It's Robin here. And the first thing I have to tell you is it's been a morning of chaos here. Poor Fran is sick. I arrived into the studio to find workmen outside hammering, so I apologise if there's any background noise. But on the good news front, we had lined up a guest today who is here and who has just been elevated from guest to co-host, and I'd like to welcome Brian Kalia, Reverend Brian Kalia, back to the podcast. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be here. Pity that Fran's not here, but hopefully we can have a stimulating conversation.
Yeah, that's right. No, and let me just say something about you, Brian, for those who don't know. Brian is a PhD candidate in Hebrew Bible, working on wisdom literature and the book of Ecclesiastes at Whitley College here in Melbourne. And he's also an ordained minister in the Congregational Christian Church of Samoa. So he brings both his, you know, scholarly expertise and his ministry expertise to these texts. It's Transfiguration Sunday, as it's often known in the lectionary cycle, and we're going to be discussing the Old Testament and the Gospel reading, so 2 Kings 2, 1 to 12, and Mark 9, 2 to 9. And we're going to start with 2 Kings. It's such a fantastic dramatic story, and it, you know, for those of you who've perhaps preached every year about the Transfiguration and really don't know what you're going to say, maybe this year you could preach on 2 Kings. And because we're going to see Brian's got some great points to make about this and some potential preaching themes. But Brian, tell us, you know, we're here in Kings, which was once one book, and it's about the kings, right? It's the establishment of monarchy and King David and but where are we in this particular story? Who are we about to encounter, and where are we in their lives with Elisha and Elijah? And
yeah, it's so in this chapter we were introduced to this character named Elisha in the previous chapter, but we're sort of finding out a little bit more about him, and this is your sort of typical. It's a succession, prophetic succession story or narrative. Mm. So we're seeing here this sort of transference of authority and power, I guess, and the prophetic voice from Elijah to Elisha in this chapter. So, if you read the Bible from a sort of, from the beginning of, the Pentateuch, working your way through, there are quite a few succession stories, but this is a unique one.
It is, and unique for lots of reasons, not least because Elijah is going to beam up to heaven, as I like to think of it. this is a vivid story with chariots of fire. One can't help but think of that music from the famous movie. Is this a story you've studied at a sort of scholarly point of view, or is this is it familiar to you at all when you went back and read it?
It was funny to reread the story again from more critical sort of scholarly type view, because prior to that, I think my last time I've sort of engaged with this story was when I was a much younger lad, growing up in Sunday school, and it was one of those real epic type stories, this real fantasy type stories where it sort of got a lot of attention in Sunday school, in our tradition. We celebrate White Sunday, which comes every second Sunday of October, and it's a Sunday where the kids take over conducting the service, and it's their time to preach to their parents. So they a lot of that service consists of plays and reenactment of Bible stories. And this is one of the stories that gets touched on a lot because it has a lot of really fantastic elements that kids enjoy and kids want to reenact. And so to come from that side of of reading it to this one. I was actually really looking forward to sort of rereading it and see, okay, I know what I felt like as a kid. I wonder what I'm going to feel about this text now that I'm reading it with a more critical mindset.
Yeah, and with all the knowledge you've gained in the meantime. It strikes me there's so many of these wonderful Hebrew Bible stories like Jonah and the flood that we are sort of vivid in our minds from Sunday school, but we don't always revisit them as adults. And yes. I think that's such a shame because there's rich theology to be found. So perhaps let's get into that. I mean, I can see why kids would act this out because it's dramatic. It's maybe even funny in places. It's got these repeated refrains. But what did you notice in the text? What do you take us through some of the exegetical points and perhaps can we start with the repeated refrains? We've got this kind of stay here, this interaction, you know, with Elijah saying, you know, stay here, pray, the Lord's sending me somewhere. And every time Elisha replies with basically no, I will not forsake you.
That was perhaps one of the most funniest things that, you know, I really didn't pay any attention to before. But, you know, rereading the story, especially when you're taking this narrative as a succession narrative, you're sort of expecting a lot of attitudes of obedience and, you know, in order to ensure that there's a successful transition of authority and power. So you don't really want to mess things up by disobeying. But here, there's quite a lot of disobedience occurring from Elisha.
Yep.
You know, Elijah's staying is telling Elisha to stay here. And the, you know, the language there in the Hebrew is quite emphatic and imperative. It's a command. It's not, please stay here. It's not in that nature. It's more, you must stay here. You know, that's the type of feel that this command is coming. But repeatedly, Elisha, you know, ignores the request and says, no, I will not leave you. You know, that was the thing that sort of popped out at first that, you know, I didn't really see before when I was reading before, but now I was just like looking, okay, this is weird. I said earlier that this is not your typical succession. I mean, I said it was typical by mistake, but then I said, no, it's not typical because there's a lot of atypical things that actually occurs, and this was probably the first thing.
Yeah, and it is striking when you think of the power dynamics between these two. In a succession story, you're handing on the leadership. There's a sense that, you know, Elisha is the pupil or disciple or whatever language you want to, you know, use. He's learning and he will be handed the mantle, so to speak. But, is a pious reading that he knows something from God, or is it a sign of his stubborn faithfulness that he says, I'll stay with you? Or do you think we're actually supposed to just find some humor in this?
it's interesting because reading the conversations that Elijah has Elisha has with the people, they're talking to Elisha and saying, you know, do you not know that your master that the Lord will take your master away from you? But if you go back to the Hebrew, it's the language is saying that, do you know that the Lord will take your master above you? So there's already an allusion there in the text that this chariot of fire is going to come and take Elijah away. So that's the message that us as readers are going to see if we do Hebrew, that there is something really magical that's going to happen, you know, that will, you know, something that will take up. I mean, the language above suggests that something's going to go up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the illusion. But then you see, and then when you see Elijah's response, Elisha's response, sorry, with these two having,
I know the names are too similar. I get them constantly. Yeah.
But Elisha's response is quite, when you sort of make sense of what the people are saying, and then you hear his response. He says the NRSV translates his response as "be silent," as if to suggest a rebuking tone. But going back to the Hebrew, the language there, the word hasha is probably better translated as be calm or be still.
Be still, yeah.
Yeah, because hasha has that sense of, you know, one of the better sort of visions of the word hasha is the if you see the waters after a storm, it's, you know, it's all, it becomes a lot more calmer than what it was before. So there is this sense where, I mean, if you read it that way, it's not a rebuking tone, but it's just say, just be calm. I know what's going on. Something's going to happen, but I'm aware of it. You know, no need to panic, that type of response.
Yeah, which I think is more helpful. I mean, it's also more faithful to the translation, but it's more helpful in understanding the story than the be silent, because the be still, which is Robert Alter has that, which I quite like. In a sense, it is just trust, just wait, just be in the moment. You know, don't, you know, I'm just jumping ahead here, but as Christians, when things change or leadership changes or we're faced with sort of supernatural or unusual experiences, we want to do something, we want to run around frantically, we want to feel like we can do something to regain control. And three times we get this, I know, be still, just be, you know.
Yeah.
It's quite, so I mean, that's potentially one whole theme right there in the in that repeated.
That's right. And ironically, he's already showing leadership there.
Yeah.
By that response, which is
yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think something you said before sparked this thought that you know, in many ways as a succession story, this is a simple handing over of leadership, the validation of both the great authority that Elijah had but now being given to Elisha, and a kind of a comfort in that for all of us that God does not leave God's people without leaders. But I think we get distracted by the ascension stuff, the supernatural stuff, because it's so weird.
Yeah.
But in the story, I was actually struck rereading it myself that no one else is like, everyone's like, oh, you know, this is what's going to happen. And they're like, yeah, you know. No one else is surprised that Elijah's about to get beamed up to heaven with chariots of fire, you know.
Yeah, we've all become sort of focused on that element, but the people in the story themselves are not don't invoke that type of response.
Yeah, exactly. So we've got this, you know, three times. I mean, this wonderful repeated refrain, but then we get to the end, and there's all these other kind of symbolic type things that happen: separating of waters and garments. And what do you make of all of that?
Yeah, it's I mean, when a thing happens once, maybe twice, maybe it's coincidence. But when it happens three times or more, then there seems to be some sort of a pattern established. So you know, this type of allusion to the separation occurs right throughout this passage. And you know, it begins right at, you know, at the beginning of the verse, and then you see these symbolic actions that take place. You know, the parting of the waters in verse 8, the chariot of fire separating the two in verse 11, and then you know, quite sad for us to see at verse 12, Elisha mourns and tears his clothes into two pieces.
Yeah.
So. This whole separation, you know, we've got it, I think it sort of highlights for us that there's always two sides to things. There's, you know, the old adage, you know, there's two sides to the story.
Yep.
And maybe this is what they're trying to tell us you know, by these different symbols that occur. You know, within that separation, we must acknowledge that there are always, I mean, within that separation, there are two parts that we sort of need to take into consideration. Often when things are separated, we have a view of what's in the middle, but I think this time the author is probably telling us, well, let's pay attention to what's happening on the two ends. And I think, you know, there's something there that sort of opens up our minds as readers when we start focusing on those two ends. Mm.
And imagining perhaps, you know, the feelings of different people in the story. You know, exactly. On the one hand, there's such glory and divine affirmation of the prophets in this ascension of Elijah. I mean, it's only him and Enoch, and then there's mystery around Moses' death as well. But this is kind of very special people in the tradition that have this kind of ending taken up while alive. But, you know, that separation stuff you've pointed out, it just strikes me it's also laced with some grief, right?
Yes.
You know, because it is also a separation story.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think that's essentially why we alluded to these symbols, these parting symbols or these separating symbols, because you're going to see two ends. And as you said, I mean, when we think about, I mean, fire in the Old Testament is a common symbol for God's glorious presence and God's, you know, God's power and might.
Mm.
And then we see, but what we see, what we don't see is, or what we don't pay attention to is that, you know, aside from that glory and that whole joy, there are people that are taking a different side to what's happening or what's occurring. And we see that in Elisha's response when he cries out, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And scholars are sort of divided on what this means. You know, there's not much consensus on as to what exactly these words are trying to say. So everyone sort of has their own take on it. But I find it very peculiar, and that these same words appear probably verbatim in the chapter 13 of this of Second Kings, where this time it's King Joash that cries these words. And King Joash cries these words in response to Elisha falling mortally ill. So these words then, therefore, evoke a sense of grief.
Their lament.
And they have a lament feel to it, which is not the response you would expect when someone sees something glorious like a chariot of fire whisking off in the whirlwind up into the heavens. So, you know, again, going back to the idea of these symbols of separation, you're seeing two sides now. You're seeing the side of glory and power, but then you're also seeing the lament and the troubling Elisha, who's trying to come to terms with this. Might be his way of seeing it, that Elijah for him has probably fallen.
Still an ending of that relationship on earth, with all the glory and the unusual nature of it, it's still an ending.
That's right.
Thank you for pointing that out, because you kind of read that, and it's at surface level, it could be an exclamation of wonder, like, look at these things in the heavens, or just to kind of, but when we do unpack the my father and where that gets used in other contexts, it points out, and I mean, from a very human level, you can understand this, that, you know, Elisha, he is now taking on this prophetic calling. You know, and any of us who've stepped into leadership positions, there's a certain kind of fear and grief and all sorts of things tied up with, A, when a mentor dies or leaves, and B, the fear of like stepping up and can I fill these shoes? And, you know, all of that is kind of, you know, there's such emotion in what is.
That's right.
You know,
I mean, these words also appear in Psalms, and I mean, the very words that, I mean, well, my father. The words from the psalm that Jesus evokes on the cross as well. So it has that. I mean, it certainly carries those undertones of grief and dismay. I mean, my Lord, why have you forsaken me? You know, that whole. It's
and love and trust and everything all bound up in there. Like
that's right.
Know, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Exactly.
Complex.
And that's probably. And that's probably, and I love that you've pointed that out. That's probably the more important thing to now that we've been pointed out to these different to these two ends, and the separation of, and seeing these two sides is that it'll make more sense of what occurs in the middle.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we start opening up a lot of more a lot of great theological responses, you know, especially when the grace of God and those type of questions.
Yeah. And I mean, we haven't really touched on it, and we need to move on because we're almost out of time, but I was struck with this double share of, you know, the Spirit is what he asked for. And I mean, as we reflect on leadership and our own people have mentored us in faith, I mean, it got me thinking about, you know, who would we ask in our own lives for a double share of their Spirit? You know, who do we aspire to be like in faith? And I think there's an awful lot here you've unpacked for us, Brian Collier, that, you know, preachers could pick up and really work with.
Yeah.
We'll be back in just a moment to discuss Mark 9.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find the link at our website, bythewell.com.au.
So the gospel reading this week is Mark chapter 9, 2-9, Jesus' transfiguration. It's probably a very familiar story to many of you. And we're here at a point in Mark's gospel. The lectionary has leapt us ahead, and I think for a couple of reasons. One is we're at this last week before Lent starts. So there's something in the wisdom of the lectionary that likes to give us a glimpse of glory and resurrection and future ascension and power before we enter that period of Lent where we're kind of more focused on penitence and the death of Jesus with the cross hovering. So we're getting this sort of tension, some of the tensions we just talked about in the 2 Kings reading. We're also at a point in Mark's gospel here where Jesus has just a few verses before this talked explicitly for the first time about the Son of Man must suffer and die and on the third day be raised again, and that famous scene where Peter rebukes him and says, no, this can't be so. So again, Jesus is starting to teach them about the nature of what his leadership will look like, and that actually it is a suffering kind of leadership. It will be costly. And they're on the way to Jerusalem, which is, of course, where Jesus dies. So the verse the lectionary has left out is this rather strange verse about, you know, Jesus saying, I tell you, there are some here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God come with power. But we have death and power kind of juxtaposed, again, tensions that are competing. In terms of, you all know this story, there's a basic movement of ascent, revelation and descent. And I think 2 key things emerge for me, and I'll ask Brian what emerges for him in a moment. One is that the nature of Jesus is revealed visually. So there's a visual change, a metamorphosis is the language, where his garments become, you know, super white and radiant, such as no one on earth can whiten them. And white clothing is a symbol of divinity in the biblical and in the wider Greco-Roman tradition. Matthew and Luke will add that Jesus' face changes, but Mark doesn't have that detail. So if you are preaching the gospel, be specific to what Mark's doing. But the other thing that's revealed here, so that there's a visual kind of big clue for the disciples looking on that suddenly reveals who Jesus is in a different kind of way to just his earthly form. But the other revelation really comes in the divine voice. In verse 7 and 8, this is my son, the beloved, listen to him. Again, a command to listen. So there's something here we could play with around seeing and hearing and what it means to be attentive to God in our midst and what God is doing, both visually, where do we see God, where do we experience God visually, and where do we hear God in terms of really listening. I mean, there's one thing to hear something, there's another thing to be attentive and tuned in and really listen to what those words mean. And of course, in verse 7 with that, this is my son, the beloved, it takes us right back to the baptism of Jesus, to that authority for his mission and ministry, and to that great claim Mark starts his gospel with, that this is the Son of God, which is a huge theological claim. There's a lot we could unpack here, but is there anything that struck you, Brian, or connections you'd want to make with the other reading we discussed?
Obviously the first thing, you know, is the appearance of these two great Old Testament figures, Moses and Elijah. And I guess the common thing between the two, I mean, amongst a lot of things, is their ambiguous endings in the Old Testament. You know, one gets taken off in a chariot, as we just read, and the other sort of had this really unknown death in somewhere in the mountains. And then, you know, we're sort of wondering, where are these two? Where did they go? And then all of a sudden they appear here in Mark 9. Here they are.
Yeah, they're back and they're chatting with Jesus. Yep.
Yeah, so I don't know if there's some sort of a fulfillment occurring here in response to those ambiguous endings, because, you know, I think it's quite funny that we have Moses, who was sort of told that he's not going to appear and he's not going to the promised land. That was his punishment in the Old Testament. But then here he appears in the promised land next to Jesus. So, you know, is maybe this sort of a sort of an ending for them where they find some sort of, some fulfillment as to some of the things that they wish they had fulfilled.
Or an acknowledgement that they didn't see it in the way we expect. You know, Moses famously dies and is buried in an unknown place and on the cusp of entering the land. But there's a sense he's seen it in another way. Like, it's not that he fell out of favor with God entirely, you know. Exactly. I love your phrase ambiguous endings, because, of course, in Mark, Jesus has such an ambiguous ending. I mean, this is the gospel that doesn't really have a resurrection narrative. It just ends with everyone like running away from an empty tomb with fear. So even though there's a clear reference to the resurrection in this passage, you know, when we get to the end of Mark, it's the definition of an ambiguous ending for Jesus and his ministry. Like, what next? Where is he? What happened? Kind of thing. Yeah, it's beautiful. What else was I going to say? The talking with Moses and Elijah, we talk about this a lot on this podcast, but it struck me too. It's, you know, this is just three Jewish prophets having, you know, I think part of the work that does is just put Jesus slap bang in this tradition. You know, it reminds us this is the tradition Jesus stands in. And, of course, they all have mountain experiences too of the divine, with Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai and the giving of the law. And Elijah, I think, is the one who has he asks to see God, and it's the still small voice. He sees God's back. That's up a mountain. Anything else you'd want to say if you were preaching this week or
just one final thing. You pointed out, in this current context, it's troubling, the idea of whiteness emerging in this text, and, you know, the associations of white with holiness and divine and the glory of God. I speak as a person of color. What do I make of that in this current climate in particular? But I always try to look of some subversive type elements when I saw that part in verse 7, then a cloud overshadowed. That sort of thought to me, okay, all right, we've got something there.
We've got something to play with there, yep.
Yeah, we've got something there to sort of darken up the white a bit.
I love that. No, thank you for saying that, because I feel increasingly, you know, uneasy with how often whiteness is evoked in the Bible as a sign of holiness or what, you know, and in deeply problematic ways sometimes. So I would prefer to talk about Jesus here as dazzling or something.
Yes.
You know, whether you're black or white, you can be dazzling.
Right. I point this out, because I know that there are certainly white preachers who would sort of be troubled with this.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, there's always something to sort of counter that, you know. Yeah. And for me, to see the Lord overshadowing them, or I think the Greek word sort of refers to darkening them.
Yeah, it is. Yep.
It's from this darkness that this voice says, "This is my son." I mean, it's not like the Lord came and made them even more whiter, but it was this cloud overshadowing. You know, to see it from that point of view, it was really interesting to see this type of.
Yeah, thank you. Because that word, I think the English, what does it have? Overshadowed, but I mean, it is literally a cause to darken. So I love this idea that in the causing of darkness, the divine comes, and that too is a amazing sign of God's presence and beauty and
yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Brian, for being with us today, for stepping into the chair as more than guest, being
my pleasure,
and for bringing so much of your own wisdom and experience and scholarly knowledge to unpacking these texts. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.